Last week, CBO released its long-term budget outlook. Let me just highlight quickly two implications of that report. The first involves the trade-off between the amount of taxes we collect and the benefits we provide through Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Our report shows that it is possible to keep taxes at their historical average share of GDP, but only by making substantial cuts relative to current law in the benefits provided to a broad group of Americans at some point in their lives. Alternatively, the report shows that it is possible to keep current law for those large entitlement programs unchanged, but only by raising taxes substantially on a broad group of Americans. Changes in other federal programs besides the large entitlements can affect the magnitude of the changes needed in taxes or those large entitlements, but they can't eliminate the basic trade-off I've described. That is the hard truth that I think we have not yet confronted as a country. The second implication I want to highlight from the report involves the constraint that Congress faces if it wants to keep debt on the gradually declining path relative to current law that we project, relative to GDP, rather, that we project under current law. That may not be the optimal path. Analysts don't know what the optimal path of debt is. But that's at least a plausible goal for national policy. If Congress chose to pursue that goal, to keep debt on that gradually declining path relative to GDP, then any actions it took that would significantly worsen the budget deficit relative to current law would need to be offset or paid for through other changes of comparable magnitude. For example, removing the automatic spending reductions in the Budget Control Act would increase deficits by about $1 trillion over the next decade. And extending all the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts and indexing the AMT for inflation would raise deficits by about $4.5 trillion over the next decade, both things leaving aside the debt service costs. Making such changes to current law while maintaining this gradually declining path of debt relative to GDP would require other changes that would reduce deficits by $1 or $4.5 trillion. So let me stop there and see if you have questions about that or last week's report or anything else that CBO is working on.
Let me ask you a couple of, well, as we discussed the last time you were here, I hear you're a baseball fan, so this is the portion of the program where I do the softball question. So you were, when you were here last year, you said a great deal of the pain of this downturn lies in front of us still. Is that still correct? Have we gone through most of the pain, or is more pain coming?
There's still a good deal of pain to come. We've been through a year of still very high unemployment, and especially high by our historical standards, long-term unemployment. We are now working on the economic forecast we will release in August, but in broad terms, the view we had in January of an economy that we expect to grow slowly, I think still holds. What we said in January was that we would only get down unemployment down to the neighborhood of 5% by 2018. And I don't know exactly what the new forecast will show, but it will be something, I think, in that ballpark. So there is still a great deal of elevated unemployment to come.
Let me ask you about the European debt crisis. Last time you were here, you said the probability of a sovereign debt crisis in Europe having a big effect on the U.S. economy is small, but difficult to rule out, given the interconnections in the financial system and the difficulty in being able to trace those interconnections. As you know, yesterday, borrowing costs for Spain and Italy surged into the 6% range. The head of the IMF had some grim things to say. What's your take on the amount of risk to the U.S. economy from the European debt crisis? Has it increased?
We are quite concerned about the situation in Europe and its potential implications for the United States. I think the risks today are larger than they were when I was last here. Although the European governments have managed a succession of times to pull their economies and their financial system back from the brink, the the challenges they face are larger than ever now, and getting out of their current situation is very difficult. And whether they will be able to preserve the euro, I think, is unclear. And if European economies slow more than they already have, or especially if there is some greater tumult in the European financial system, that will be bad news for the U.S. economy. There's one silver lining in the cloud, which is that fears about the stability of the financial system in Europe tend to increase the demand for U.S. Treasury securities, and thus push down the interest rates on those securities, push down the cost of our borrowing. But beyond that, the fears of the what's happening in Europe and what might happen in Europe are weighing on our stock market. They're weighing on business confidence and thus on hiring and investment in this country. And again, if something goes even more wrong there, that can reduce the exports that we can send to Europe and could cause a great deal of further problems in our own financial system. But how to quantify that, either the size of the risk or the risk of something even worse happening or the effects on the U.S. economy is very difficult.
Paul?
I'd like to ask you about sequester. There are different estimates of the amount of discretionary cash floating around. I think the last estimate I've seen from CBO is $98 billion cut to discretionary next year, a total of $100 billion. I'm wondering if that's still your estimate, $98 billion, because I've seen $94 billion, for example. And then also wondering what the projected hit to the economy is, 0.5% or whether it's more, and how that bears the hit to the economy from allowing all the tax cuts to expand.
I don't have with me our latest report on sequestration. If you've read the report that we released early this year, it's on our website. I think those are our latest estimates.
Okay.
But remember that the process of sequestration would be implemented by the Office of Management and Budget, not by CBO. It is their interpretation of the law that ultimately matters. We offer our interpretation as information for the Congress, but we're not the determining authority in how that plays out. When we released our report last month on the economic effects of reducing the fiscal restraint scheduled to occur next year, we included a set of pieces of current law that will impose that restraint, and we looked at the economic effects of the pieces together. We did not try to look at the economic effects piece by piece. As we said at the time, of the maybe I should explain. Those who have not read this report, there is, as you do know, a large set of tax policies due to expire at the end of this year. Some new tax policy is scheduled to come into effect, and there's a very large cut in spending scheduled to occur at the end of this year. The effect of that on the budget deficit is very positive in the near term, but the effect on the economy is very negative in the near term. And our estimate is that if current law unfolds, that the economy will actually shrink in size the first half of next year, along the lines of what in the past the National Bureau of Economic Research has deemed a recession. What we showed in this report is that by far the larger share of the fiscal tightening comes from these changes in tax policies. So the calculation we show here is about $400 billion of effect from changes in a set of key revenue policies, about $100 billion from key spending policies, and another $100 billion from a collection of other things we don't specify. So the tightening is very much focused on the tax side. But each piece of tightening doesn't necessarily have the same effect on the economy. When we model the effects of the changes in fiscal policy on the economy, we look at the nature of each change. So you can't take the proportions of the budget dollars and apply that to the economic effects altogether. But it is true that by far the larger share is due to tax policy, of the budget change is due to tax policies, and also the larger share of the economic effects are due to tax policies.
Brian? Excuse me, Brian?
talk about Europe as sort of a downside risk to the economy, a big one. Can you name a few potential upside risks that could see growth occur quicker than most forecasters are projecting? Relatedly, that document you released last month forecasted pretty robust growth if lawmakers do a full punch on current policy. And I was curious, why do you expect growth to be so substantial if the policies in place right now are extended, given that we're not resulting in growth right now?
Well, those are two good and related questions, as you understand. I think there are a number of reasons why the economy could do better than we and others expect. One is on the housing side. Housing starts, I think, are around 500,000 right now. We and other analysts think that the level of housing starts needed to keep up with the underlying demographics of our country is about 1.5 million starts per year. So at the moment, we have excess unused houses, and we have a very restrained rate of household formation. So more and more people who are living with their parents or other family members or friends who in a stronger economy would strike out on their own. So to some extent, the weakness in the housing market is because of the weakness in the broader economy. On the other hand, strength in the housing market could help boost the rest of the economy in a positive way. So I think one possibility is that housing will start to rebound more sharply than we've projected. And again, the underlying fundamentals suggest that we could use a lot more housing construction over time than we have right now. Businesses are sitting on a lot of cash. They have not shown a great interest in using that. But why they happened is not entirely clear. And business investment, in fact, is growing fairly strongly, but from a depressed level. It fell very sharply during the downturn. So even though it's been growing rapidly in the last couple of years, it's still at a low level relative to the size of the economy, relative to the size of the capital stock, and businesses might decide they want to do more investment than we've written down. The unemployment rate has fallen more sharply than we and most analysts expected. Just why that's happening is also a bit of a puzzle. But it raises the possibility that there is more strength in the labor market than we expect. So we think our forecasts, we try to put our forecasts in the middle of a range of possible outcomes, seeing risks on both sides. And I think there are a few risks that stand out on the downside, like Europe. But I think and for many people, it's a puzzle that this recovery has been as weak as it's been. And I think there are reasons for it, but it's not at all impossible that more of the underlying strength of the economy could show itself in the next year or two.
Colleagues, question? Sue.
Can you talk about what the budget impact would be or how significant it would be if the Supreme Court throws out the health care law?
Well, it depends on just what the Supreme Court does. I'll talk about a few possibilities. One possibility is the Supreme Court does nothing to the law. Second possibility is that the Supreme Court throws out the mandate to buy health insurance. We did an estimate in our big budget options volume last spring of what would happen if the Congress took away the mandate. We do options for the Congress, not for the court. If the Supreme Court were to eliminate the mandate, then that estimate would give you a sense, would not be precisely what we might estimate today, but it will give you a sense of it. What we said then was that taking away the mandate would reduce the number of people who end up with health insurance to a significant degree. It would raise the cost per person in the health insurance exchanges because those who stop getting insurance would be disproportionately the healthier ones. So you'd have a sicker pool on average, and that would be more expensive for the government per person in the exchanges. But fewer people would be in the exchanges, and fewer people would be enrolled in Medicaid. So on balance, the federal government would save a few hundred billion dollars over the coming decade. I forget the exact number we gave at the time. Now, the Supreme Court went beyond throwing out the mandate and threw out the mandate plus the provisions for guaranteed issue of insurance policies and community rating. Then we don't know what the budgetary effects would be. We've not produced any estimates of that. If the Supreme Court were to throw out the entire law, then, again, we don't have a precise estimate today, but we did last February produce an estimate of the effects of H.R. 2, the bill in the House that would have repealed the Affordable Care Act. And that estimate is close to, but not quite, a reversal of the signs of our estimate of the enactment, of the effects of the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, also with a shift in the budget window. But as you remember, our estimate of the enactment of the Act was that it would, implemented as written, would reduce budget deficits a little bit over the coming decade. And our estimate of the effects of H.R. 2 was that it would increase deficits by a little bit over the coming decade. And the reason, as you know, is that the Act puts in place a substantial expansion of health insurance subsidies, but it also put in place cutbacks, significant cutbacks in spending under Medicare and some other changes in spending, and also significant increases in tax revenue. And in our assessment, the balance of those in the Act itself was to reduce deficits and thus repeal or throwing out by the Supreme Court would increase deficits. But I want to caution that when the Supreme Court rules, if they do something to the Act that then invalidates our baseline projections, we will do new estimates. And because we would use updated economic assumptions and updated technical assumptions, and the passage of time itself matters a little bit, we don't know exactly what our estimates would show. I'm just trying to point you to some of the things we've done before that would be related. But you shouldn't take those numbers as the gospel of what would happen now.
So just to follow up, so two kinds of follow-ups. There was a story out yesterday from the Centers, or a report from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services saying that healthcare costs would jump 7.4% in 2014 if the healthcare law takes effect. From what you're saying, is it basically the case that economists don't know what's going to happen in the healthcare sector of the economy? I mean, that you can get projections like that, but until you see what comes from the court, it's all up in the air?
Well, I should say, I don't mean to demean
economists.
No, that's been done enough already.
Yeah, that's right.
Done by
more skillful folks than me.
I think the folks at CMS do projections under current law,
right,
just as we do. And changes in law can affect outcomes an awful lot, even though under the same law, projections are a very uncertain business, especially in the healthcare area. We don't do ourselves projections of national health expenditures. The actuaries at CMS construct the historical data on national health expenditures and do the projections of it. We don't do comparable projections. So we don't have numbers directly to compare to theirs. Of course, we project the federal parts of healthcare spending, and because of the, which is a significant part of spending, and we do some projections of things like private insurance premiums because they're an important input to our projections now of federal subsidies through insurance exchanges. We do many of the pieces, but not all the pieces, so we don't have a total estimate.
Colleagues, yeah, Brian,
and then a related question. So if the Supreme Court on both of those two issues says they're unconstitutional, but they're to mandate this, but there are states like New York, I read from New York papers, that want to do this, would New York still get the money? Would the money still be spent on the expansion of Medicaid? Would the money still be spent on health care exchanges? Because New York is already in the process of creating one. So, and the tax credit.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and I want to be careful about offering legal opinions. I have been advised by some lawyers. Usually their advice is not to answer our questions.
Which is why economists like them so much, right?
It depends what the court does. There are particular provisions of the Act that are the mandate to purchase health insurance. If that particular provision was extracted and everything else stood, then the federal government would still be running a tax code with tax credits to help pay for health insurance to people in insurance exchanges. It's a different title of the Act that established the expansion of Medicaid. So if the court really did just excise the mandate alone, then the rest of the law would continue to function. So our estimate of the effects, when we published last winter, of the effects of Congress repealing the mandate, was an estimate of just extracting that one piece. But the subsidies and the expansion of Medicaid and so on would stand. Of course, the Supreme Court could do different sorts of things, and I don't know. We talked about the range of possibilities, and there seems to be quite a wide range.
So So in other words, some states could go ahead, the ones that want to go ahead.
But if it were just the mandate that went away, then I think that states could go ahead to, in some sense, would need to go ahead, because the law would still, again, if just that piece were extracted, the rest of the law would still make people eligible for tax credits for buying health insurance through exchanges. They would expect the exchanges to be there, and people would still be eligible for Medicaid who were not eligible under prior law, and the states would need to be ready to serve those people.
We're going to go over here, and then to Alexis, Gail, and Nancy. Yes, sir.
On the Supreme Court decision, if they were to strike down the mandate and the subsidies ended up being canceled and the government saved $200 billion, whatever the number is there any reason why Congress couldn't book those savings in place of the sequester for next year?
So let me first clarify the beginning of that. When the estimate we made of taking away the mandate, the subsidy rules remain in place. We're just estimating that fewer people would turn up to take advantage of the subsidies, because they would not be required to anymore. The savings that would be achieved that way would be under then current law, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, just a reduction in future budget deficits. Congress could then enact legislation that would take away the sequester. Those would really be two separate actions, in a sense. And the Supreme Court would have produced an interpretation of current law under their scenario that would save the federal government money. Separately, the Congress could do something that would widen budget deficits. I don't see a natural connection between those pieces. Could one then add them up as all the things that have happened to the deficit between June 1st and some other date? Yes, I suppose so. But there's no sense of reallocating. There's no fund of money. It's not like there's a piggy bank there with all of the money that would be used to pay for these subsidies that then has no other use. You could just sort of dump it out to take somewhere else. The government's running large budget deficits. On net, we're borrowing money at a very fast clip. So I don't think in general that savings that would arise through the actions of the court would provide financing for some other activity.
Alexis?
Doug, I don't know if you talked about this before I came in, but I have two questions that aren't really related. The first one is, obviously there's been a flirtation with the clip extending for a short period of time to get out of it into 2015. First of all, can you talk about the pros and cons as you see it, of thinking that way, that that's a possibility? The second question is, the Fed and many others have talked about the concern of the long-term unemployment and what the economic impact would be over a long period of time of watching that phenomenon occur. Can you talk about that at all and what we should be thinking about in that context?
Yes. The first question about extending the fiscal cliff. As we've written, Congress faces a very difficult trade-off in deciding how quickly to implement policies to reduce budget deficits. The faster the policies are implemented, the less the run-up in the debt, and thus the less the crowding out of capital investment, the less future interest payments would be elevated, the more flexibility policymakers would have to deal with future contingencies. On the other hand, the faster deficit cuts are implemented, the less time that households and businesses and state and local governments have to plan and adjust their behavior, and under current economic conditions, the bigger the hit to the economy. So there's no obvious answer to that, and that facing that trade-off. That's what Congress has to decide.
Well, you're no help.
Excuse me?
You're no help.
Well, we're trying to explain and quantify the trade-off, but ultimately Congress has to make the choices. I mean, I think specifically, if they were, if Congress allowed current law to unfold, then as we projected, the economy would probably fall back into recession in the first half of next year. Very large economic and human cost to that. On the other hand, if they simply extended everything indefinitely, then debt ends up on a completely unsustainable path. There are very large economic and human costs to that as well. As we've written a number of times, it's possible to do a combination policy where one extends some provisions for a while or puts in place provisions to support the economy for a while over the medium and long term restraining deficits. And analytically, that can be done, but it's complicated. And I think to make it work at all, the
the future restraint, the future increases in taxes or reductions in spending, would need to be specified. It would need to be spelled out pretty clearly to be convincing to people that they would actually take effect. And if future fiscal restraint were convincing, that would not only be good when it unfolded, it would probably be good in the short run as well, because it would provide some confidence that we were on a sustainable fiscal path, and would also show people what would happen, so they wouldn't be as uncertain about just what changes would be made. So we've said a number of times that we don't see a trade-off in when decisions are made. It's better to make decisions sooner. The trade-off is in how the deficit reduction, how the fiscal restraint is phased in.
And a long-term one.
Yes, so we are, we think the Fed is right to be concerned about the elevated level of long-term unemployment. Really is striking how much higher long-term unemployment is today than it's been in past economic downturns. And our economic projections build in some lasting effect of that in keeping the unemployment rate elevated. And the logic is basically that people who lose jobs and stay out of work for a long time have skills that deteriorate, and they have connections to the job market that dwindle, and they find it harder then to be to re-enter the labor force, to re-enter employment, and to re-enter in the sort of permanent job where they are very productive, as they were before they lost their jobs. So we have built into our projection an elevated unemployment rate even at the end of the decade because of the high levels of long-term unemployment today. Whether we built in the right amount is very hard to know. We spent a long time with our panel of economic advisors recently talking about labor market issues. Economists have a range of views, and we're trying to learn from the set of people that we talk with how best to build this into our forecast. But I think it's a serious problem. We wrote a separate report published a few months ago, I think, about policies that could address elevated unemployment. And some of those policies are of a macroeconomic sort. The amount of demand for goods and services, the strength of the overall economy can matter. But also, we spent most of the time in that study talking about more microeconomic policies, structural changes the government could encourage in the labor market that might help. So I think it's a very, serious economic problem.
Gail?
It's been a kind of doomsday scenario about unsustainable deficits for decades now. And it goes something like this. We cannot continue on this path because interest rates will rise. And usually when someone who's in the panel or someone like Kent Conrad makes the point, they say, not just that they'll rise, but they'll spike up in some unexpected way and it will be a disaster. People aren't saying that much anymore because after decades of saying it, interest rates have stayed low. And you just said, because of Europe, they're likely to go even lower. So how do you factor in this 500-pound gorilla that every economist says is out there? At some point, there will be a bond option and no one will come. And then the whole society will change.
Well, I think the key here is that the amount of borrowing by the federal government is only one of the factors that affects the interest rates that the federal government pays. And there's some other important factors that are right now pushing very strongly down on interest rates. One is the weakness of the economy. And that has reduced the private demand for credit, just less borrowing that people, businesses, are trying to do. Relatedly, it's caused the Federal Reserve to try to hold down interest rates as much as possible to encourage borrowing and spending right now. I think second factor is what I mentioned, which is the continued tumult in the global financial system. And Treasury securities are still viewed as the safest liquid asset. And I want to be clear, what I said about Europe is that I think further unraveling in Europe could push our interest rates down further. Not that I think that's necessarily going to happen now. Our what our forecast does is to project over the next half dozen years or so a gradual increase in interest rates back into the 4 to 5% neighborhood. We think that's consistent with a strengthening economy, with the amount of borrowing the federal government will be doing under current law. It's roughly consistent with the current prices in financial markets, with some adjustment for the fact that our fiscal policy assumptions, which have to follow current law, are probably different from the fiscal policy assumptions used in financial markets. But we've written a number of times about the risk of a spike in interest rates. We wrote an issue brief a few years ago about the risk of a fiscal crisis, and we say that, in general, if one looks around the world, when investors have become afraid that governments can't manage their budget problems, then there tends to be a very sharp, quick turn in sentiment. That there isn't usually a gradual increase with a lot of warning. These things tend to spike. But under the current economic conditions in this country and the current economic and financial conditions in Europe, I don't think such a spike is very likely right now.
Nancy?
We think all the pieces matter. They matter a little differently. In the analysis we've done for the last few years of the effects of the Recovery Act or the effects of alternative ways of boosting the economy, we've been careful to talk about the fact there isn't a single effect of a dollar of the budget on the economy. That depends on the nature of the provisions. When we look at the elements of the fiscal cliff, as I mentioned earlier, by far the largest part of that is on the tax side, and thus the tax effects in aggregate would have the constitute the biggest fiscal drag on the economy. Dollar for dollar, they're probably a little smaller than the effects of changes in government spending, because when the federal government spends an extra dollar or doesn't spend that dollar, then that changes the demand for goods and services by a dollar to start with. Then there are indirect multiplier effects. Whereas if the government doesn't collect a dollar in tax or does collect a dollar in tax, some of that comes out of people saving and only some out of their spending. And that's why, in fact, we don't think the economy will slow as much as the size of the fiscal cliff itself. Because some of what will happen is that private saving will fall at the beginning of next year. The rest will be a decline in private spending. So dollar for dollar, the spending changes are probably matter more for the economy than the revenue changes. But again, the aggregate amount of revenue changes is so much larger than the spending changes that together the revenue changes are probably the larger part of the economic effect. They are the larger part of the economic effect.
Yes, sir. James?
Your report from last month on the cliff seems to have had quite a big impact. And I'm wondering if, as someone deals with members of Congress on a day-to-day basis in their offices, you've seen a sort of spike in interest in dealing with the fiscal cliff, but also maybe even in a higher chance for the grand bargain. Are there more requests for a sort of assessments of budgetary implications and certain moves? I mean, is there more activity on this front, do you think, than you've seen before?
Unfortunately, I can't talk about our interactions with members of Congress and their staff. I don't know how surprising the report was to people, in a way. We've been talking about this problem for a while. Members of Congress and their staffs have been aware of it. I think there is something to doing the quantitative analysis and putting it down on paper. I read these papers, too, and I see that this has resonated. But I don't think it was really news to people on Capitol Hill. And as you know, we're always engaged in providing analysis and estimates for them of alternative policies. But how they will choose to deal with this, I just don't know. And I don't think I usually have particular insight into that. We're standing a bit aside. We're trying to give them this analysis. But what discussions they're having among themselves about policies they would vote for, I just don't know.
The report that James cited, I don't read every report you do, obviously, but it seemed quite
Boy, yeah. That's that.
Sped life, right? But it seemed somewhat more blunt than in the past. And so the question I want to ask is, the longer you're in the job, do you feel liberated to be more blunt, starker in your analysis, or am I misreading it?
I was getting ready to see you.
No, I don't feel...
Focused on it intently.
No, I don't feel any different. I mean, I think my job now is exactly what it was on January 20-whatever of 2009. We're providing information for Congress. I actually try to be as articulate and direct as I can in answering questions all the time. I mean, when we've done a specific piece of analysis, then we try to be direct in how we present that.
But without taking sides.
And sometimes when I am fuzzier in my language, it's because we haven't spent the weeks to do the precise piece of analysis, and I'm not as sure of just where we would come out.
But you don't see an evolving tone.
No. No.
Lauren?
I'm curious, the Bipartisan Policy Center released a study about the sequester and what some of the effects would be. One of the things mentioned was just the threat of a sequester and what that does to the economy. So I'm curious if you could speak upon that.
Well, we think, and we said in this report, that uncertainty about the resolution of fiscal policy early next year is weighing on the economy. We think diminishing people's and businesses' spending this year. I think we said in the report that we think it would hold down economic growth this year by about half a percentage point. Very, very hard to know. And I think even beyond the cliff itself, uncertainty about how we're going to resolve the fundamental inconsistency between our spending plans and our tax plans is weighing on the confidence of households and businesses. There's a paper by a number of economists, one of whom is on our panel of economic advisors, that tries to quantify uncertainty about policy over time and quantify its effects on the economy. Very challenging task. Their estimates suggest that uncertainty about policy is especially high recently, which seems plausible to me. And their estimates suggest that is weighing on the economy. I forget exactly how they quantify that. So we think it's an issue now and will be increasingly an issue in the second half of the year in terms of people's decisions. I mean, I remember that the most important source of uncertainty for individual households and businesses right now is about their income or the demand for their products. That's underlying economic uncertainty. But we think that uncertainty about the course of public policy is an additional source of uncertainty.
And just a quick follow-up, because this happens in the middle of a fiscal year and state and local budgets, or federal budgets, sorry, may have already allocated or spent money, I guess, does that play into the dramatic effect of a sequester?
Well, it's very hard to manage an organization that is faced with a potential immediate cutback of the size that would occur for many organizations in the government and would then spill over to people outside the government if these cuts were to take effect. So CBO is a very, very small piece of the federal government, but our own decisions about whether to replace people who leave is affected by the uncertainty of what our funding will be next year. And I think that must play out on a much, much larger scale with more significant enterprises than ours. And again, both the federal agencies that would be affected, but also the private people on the other side of that. I have friends in Washington who work in organizations that are funded in small or large extent from government grants. And the back and forth on whether they are going to have the money they need is affecting their decisions as well.
Colleagues? Yes, Sue, and then we'll go to the Washington Post after that.
So in the context that we're talking about the sequester now, is that the sequester would be a very negative economic impact on the province in its current form. But from my understanding, the whole reason why we're doing 1.2 trillion over 10 was the bare minimum deficit reduction you had to do to head off the sort of undermining of credit ratings and the standing of the dollar. So I guess my question is, if in Congress's efforts in regard, I'm not speaking to what they will do to change it, but if the 1.2 trillion over 10 isn't supplanted by a dollar for dollar, 1.2 trillion plan for deficit reduction that's different, are we getting back into a scenario where U.S. credit ratings, the sort of the dollar globally, the broader economic impact threat is still there, from the problem from the very beginning. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, I think that if the sequester, if the enforcement procedures of the Budget Control Act are just thrown out with no other changes in policy to replace them, that adds significantly to our future debt and adds to the risks that that rising debt poses. I mean, remember, under current law, it has the sequester, it has the expiration of tax cuts and so on. Our public debt declined only gradually relative to GDP. We think at the end of this year it'll be a little above 70% of GDP. Under current law, it's down to about 60% of GDP at the end of the decade, and about 50% of GDP 25 years from now, this is from our long-term budget outlook. Well, even that 50% of GDP would be higher relative, would be higher number than we've had, I think, from the 50s to about 2008. So for almost all of the last 50 years, we've had debt that's been smaller relative to GDP than would be at any point over the next 25 years, even under current law, even assuming the expiration of the tax cuts and assuming the sequester. So again, just to keep the debt on that slightly declining path requires any change in policy, any change in the law that makes the budget outcome worse, be offset by some other change in the law with a comparable improving effect on the budget. Now, we don't have to push down debt relative to GDP. That's an illustrative path. Congress could decide to let debt stay the same share or rise relative to GDP, or they could decide to try to bring debt back down more quickly toward our historical norms. But this gradually declining path under current law, again, I think is useful illustrative purposes, because it illustrates just the magnitude of the changes that we need. And the $1 trillion or so from the enforcement procedures is just a piece of that. Again, if we extended all or a large part of the expiring tax cuts, that would be many times the size, and the same issues of whether we would offset that or just allow debt to spiral up would come to.
But
the
next question is, this $1.2 trillion figure, is it arbitrary? I mean, obviously, if they could go higher, there's more grand bargains and things they can do. But if in the context of what we're trying to explain this to people, if Congress comes up with less than a $1.2 trillion deficit reduction over 10 years, I mean, is there a bare minimum threshold for looking at that?
There's no particular trigger point. We just don't know. We've written about this. We don't know what level of debt the country can sustain. It probably isn't a particular number, because it depends on people's expectations of what would happen and their sense of the will and ability of the political process to control fiscal policy. So there's no particular number that I think is critical in the economic sense. Whether certain things end up becoming critical in the political sense is, you can't judge.
Ruth, Marcus, and then back to Paul. Ruth?
I wanted to go back to the health care law for a second and ask you not about the theory impact, but the economic impact. There have been suggestions from some quarters that the existence of the law in the forest will be going to affect, have a dampening effect on the economy, and that if it were to affect, that would multiply. What is your perspective on that?
We've estimated that the law would reduce the amount of labor used in the U.S. economy by about 0.5% at the end of the decade. Most of that we've written is people choosing not to work because they can obtain health insurance at an affordable price outside of the workplace. Some of that, a smaller part of that, would be firms choosing not to hire workers because the cost would be higher in some cases. The 0.5% of the labor force is not a very big share. That's the only economic effect that we have tried to estimate. There are a lot of cross currents in the law regarding employers and employees. There are some requirements imposed on employers. On the other hand, there are also subsidies available for people to obtain health insurance that aren't there under current law. We've not tried to work out how all those changes would affect every piece of the labor market or every piece of the economy.
Sorry. Do you see current impact?
We don't think that the health care law is having a significant impact on the economy today. there are a lot of pieces of the law. Some are unfolding today, and expectations of future changes in policy under the law can matter. But we don't think it's having a significant impact on the economy today.
Paul?
You were talking earlier about uncertainty in connection with this question. There have been various calls that the OMB to spell out in detail what the effect of the action will be, programs, policies, accounts, etc. I'm wondering if you have an opinion as to whether spelling that out would reduce uncertainty, at least in turn. It wouldn't say whether this question would happen or not, but it would say if it does happen, this is how it's going to happen.
I had not thought about that question. I think the biggest uncertainty is whether it will happen or not. And I'm not sure that spelling out the particulars would make anybody feel a lot more confident about what was going on. I guess some people might discover that they were not in the firing line. But, you know, the sequester was set, the enforcement procedures were set up to apply pretty broadly across government activities. There are some exceptions, of course, but to apply pretty broadly across government activities, and thus to apply to an awful lot of private sector interactions with the government through grant programs and contracts and so on. So I think the breadth of the procedures as written into law means a lot of people would be affected. That was, I think, a design choice, deliberate choice. I'm not sure that spelling out just how they would be affected actually helps much. I think that what's needed is the clarity about whether that those procedures will be allowed to take effect or whether some change will be made in the law.
Brian?
So a technical question about your modeling. Does the economic forecast you have for if the sequester and if the full fiscal cliff is hit assume any Fed action in response to that, any easing effects on the monetary policy side of things, and what would some of those effects be? And then while I have you, can we go back to what I was asking about before? Why would there be such robust growth if Congress pushed everything off, if that growth didn't occur between 2010 and now?
So a few quick thoughts. One is that we are working on our August forecast now. In order to finish this report on the effects of the fiscal cliff, we deliberately just overlay fiscal policy changes on the forecast we've written down at the turn of the year. And I think what you'll see in August will be somewhat different in various ways. Again, we've been talking with outside forecasters about our outlook for the economy just in the past few weeks. So I don't want to hang too much on the precise numbers here. But secondly, we do see that the underlying economy gaining strength. And it's the things I talked about before. It's what's happening in the housing sector. It's businesses' desire to replace and upgrade their capital stock. It's some pent-up desire on that part of households to spend money. So we, apart from the changes in fiscal policy, we would expect strengthening of the underlying economy.
Just a different part of the business cycle that we were in 2 years
ago. I think we're in a different part of the business cycle. There's been... when you compare these numbers to outside forecasters, we don't find a lot of forecasters that have the very biggest numbers we write in this report. But outside forecasters don't have no fiscal restraint. What they usually have is some amount of extension of provisions or a cancellation of provisions. But the ones that we've talked with still have a significant amount of fiscal restraint. So I think you're not likely to see those very big numbers because people expect some restraint to occur. But one thing we try to do in our forecast is to understand the differences between our forecast and outside forecasters. It's especially hard now because we need to follow assumptions about fiscal policy that most outside forecasters don't follow, but we try to do that kind of alignment. And if we learn over this period that from looking at the data and talking to outside forecasters that we have too much underlying strength in the economy, then you'll see a somewhat weaker forecast when we publish it in August. But I don't know that yet.
Anybody who hasn't had one has been waving at me and I haven't seen in my old age. Okay, well, let me ask you about something we asked last time, which was what keeps you up at night. And when I asked you that last year, you said that you referred to a Kurt cartoon from Greg Mankiw's blog where a man is sitting in a bar. This is a good monitor joke. He's sitting in a bar, and he says to a friend, you know, I worry more about my kids than I do about the economy, and you said, what keeps me up at night is my wonderful daughters. Of course, now your daughters are a year older, so they probably keep you up more. But other than fatherly sleeplessness, is it the European debt thing that you worry about most? Or what is it that you worry about most?
What I worry about most is that our political system needs to come to grips with this fundamental choice about whether we're going to let taxes rise relative to what we're used to in the past, or cut spending on the big popular entitlement programs, or some combination. That's a difficult trade-off. It's made more difficult, I think, by a lack of understanding on the part of many Americans about where their federal dollars go. Members of Congress have very different views about the right path for policy, and so far have not been able to work out an approach that can achieve sufficient support to be enacted into law. And I worry about how long this process will go on before they are able to agree on some approach forward. That's the aspect of what's happening now that concerns me most, is just the ongoing effort. We watched this through all of last year. Congress worked very hard to try to agree to changes in policy that would put the budget on a sustainable course. They were unable to do so. And I think they will, but I worry about how long it will take for those decisions to be reached, and the effect that the delay in making decisions will have on the budget future and on the economy now and in the future.
Unless somebody waves at me, we'll close with this last question, which is about the meaning of the decline in net worth. As you know, there's this report, I guess earlier this week, that household net worth went down 38% from 2007 to 2010. And other than the sort of misery loves company aspect of it, what meaning, if any, does that have for the economy?
Well, the loss of household wealth has been an important factor restraining household spending. It's widely agreed among economists that household spending depends on the income households have, but also, very importantly, on how wealthy they feel. This report summed up something that many households know themselves and has been available in pieces and other data. The decline in stock prices, the decline in house prices over the past few years have been really dramatic. Stock price decline, we've seen a little of that in the past. The house price decline on a national level really is unprecedented in the years that most economists study in making estimates and making forecasts. So this has been a very big drag on the economy. We're actually working on, as part of our forecasting effort for August, working on a report on the causes of the slow recovery, which we hope to release later this summer. Again, part of it's something we're thinking through as part of our construction of our economic forecast. And weakness in consumer spending has been a big deal, and the loss of household wealth has been a big part of the weakness in consumer spending. This is a related question, which is whether the indebtedness itself matters. That report, as you just summarized it, and the way money economists summarize household financial conditions, takes the whole household balance sheet, all the assets, nets up the liabilities, gets a total estimate of wealth or net worth. And that's the standard variable that appears in economic models. The last few years has induced a lot more sort of renewed focus in the economics profession about whether the pieces of that balance sheet need to be broken out more carefully, whether the extra amount of debt, an awful lot of households owe more on their houses than their homes are worth today. And those are pieces of the overall balance sheet, but there's a separate question about whether the extra debt itself matters. And especially in extreme cases where everyone has more debt than the asset that it's standing behind. And I think that's an unsettled question. But I think it's quite possible that the amount of debt itself has been weighing on household spending, in addition to its contribution to the overall household wealth or net worth position.
thank you for the clarity and good humor. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.